Good evening. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, we need several things. Number one, we need to know how many of you would be serious about participating in a march on Washington in September of this year. We're letting you know in plenty of time to save money, make plans for time off, and to prepare whatever you have to prepare to be able to do it. If we don't hear from a lot of you, we're not going to waste our time because we don't have any time to waste. We're about serious business. So if you're about serious business and you would like to help us make some changes for the better in this country, I want you to drop a letter or a postcard telling us that you're willing to participate in a march in September. And don't say that you will unless you really will. And send it to the Constitution Party, Post Office Box 33390. I forgot the box number. P.O. Box 3390, St. John's, Arizona, 85936. That's the Constitution Party, P.O. Box 3390, St. John's, Arizona, 85936. Please do that. In fact, don't address it to the Constitution Party, folks. Address it to me, William Cooper. Send it to William Cooper, P.O. Box 3390, St. John's, Arizona, 85936. That's because I want to take a look and see just exactly. I want to do it myself. I want to see how many of you are serious about helping turn this country around. Also, the newspaper is being typeset and laid out as I speak. And will soon be in the mail to all of you who are charter subscribers. If you would like to subscribe to our newspaper, Veritas, it's a full-size newspaper, ladies and gentlemen. It's not a tabloid like the Spotlight, and it's not a newsletter like a lot of the things that you're getting now. It's a full-size newspaper. A copy will be sent free gratis to every congressman, every senator, every governor of every state, and a few other people. The name of the paper is Veritas, V as in Victor, E-R-I-T-A-S. If you'd like to subscribe, send $50 for 24 issues to Veritas, V-E-R-I-T-A-S, P.O. Box 3390, St. John's, Arizona, 85936. Now remember, make checks or money orders out to Veritas. If you make them out to anybody else, they will be returned to you. And I'm not kidding. They really will. They'll be returned to you because we won't be able to use them. We prefer money orders. Checks are fine. Gold or silver coin is even better. Don't go away, folks. In just a few moments, our special guest for tonight, Dr. Gene Schroeder, will be here to talk about some very important history and some very important present, which he and I both have been a part of, and some very important future. Don't go away. Don't you dare miss a word.
Never in human history has so few taken so much from so many as America's Illuminati and their warlords of Wall Street and Washington. In just 8 years, these banksters and international government gangsters took us from the greatest creditor nation to the largest debtor nation on Earth. Our standard of living has dropped like a rock for 4 out of every 5 Americans. They have foreclosed on our homes, our farms, our factories. They've exploited your jobs and surrendered our arms.
They want a new world order. A new world order. A new world order. A new world order.
The Illuminati wants you to be a slave from birth to grave. The banksters own the Federal Reserve. It's private. They own it. It's neither federal nor a reserve. The cashes make that fiat funny money stuff you call dollars for 2 pennies. They lend it back to us at full face value. Then charge you interest. You get the debt. They get the interest. They get the gold.
You get the chaff.
Yes, they want it all. Welcome to the Hour of the Time, Mr. Gene Schroeder.
Bill, with great respect, it's my pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's a great honor to have you with us tonight. Everybody out there is certainly waiting to hear what you have to say. So without further ado, why don't you give us a little background about who you are and then just go right into the history of how we got where we're at and do your thing. You do it so well.
Bill, a little history. I'm a doctor of veterinary medicine. Born and raised in Campo, Colorado, a small town in southeastern Colorado. Also farmer, rancher, have been all my life. Back in the late 70s, 1977, we realized that the federal government had total control of everything we do as farmers and ranchers in this nation. And we realized that under that total authoritarian control of government, under that planned agenda, that the family farms were being eliminated from the farms. So back many years ago, we knew that we had to take a stand, that unless we done something, that there would be no family farms left in this country. That's how we became involved. Beginning to study, how did the federal government obtain this kind of control over us? Obviously, the Constitution did not allow for a federal government of this magnitude. That the Constitution did not allow a federal government to have a police power within the states, within the bodies of the counties of the states. And yet it was obvious that they were doing it and had been doing it for many years. That I was born in 1947, and that's all I knew was government control over agriculture. So as a result, that's how we became involved. That's how we began our study of what was going wrong. It took us several years to finally come to the realization that this country was operating as a war government under the war powers, and that under those conditions, the Constitution of this United States is effectively set aside, and the government can, in fact, and has, in fact, taken total authoritarian control over everything that we do, not only in agriculture, but in all other aspects and all other areas as well.
Now we can trace this back to a specific time in our history, and that's shortly after the passage of the Federal Reserve Act and the War Powers Act of 1917, and then the economic collapse, which certainly came out of the establishment of the central bank and the control of our money supply by private concerns. And then the steps that the newly elected President Roosevelt took in bringing this so-called emergency under control, this all actually really, really got rolling in 1933. Is that correct?
Yes, it did. And let me read just a little bit from the congressional record there in 1933. 1933. This is Congressman James Beck. And he says, I think of all the damnable heresies that have ever been suggested in connection with the Constitution, the doctrine of emergency is the worst. It means that when Congress declares an emergency, there is no Constitution. This means it's death. He goes on and says that it's the very doctrine that the German chancellor was using at that time. Remember, this is 1933.
That's correct.
That this is the same powers that Chancellor Hitler used to take over Germany, Weimar Germany. That was Article 48 of that Weimar Constitution, the emergency powers that were allowed there. And that under these powers, there is no Constitution. That means it's death. Now let me read just a little bit from Senate Report 93-549, just to make the case. This is our senator speaking to us. This is done in 1973. It says, since March the 9th of 1933, the United States has been in a state of declared national emergency. It says, this vast range of powers taken together confer enough authority to rule this country without reference to normal constitutional processes. Says, under the powers delegated to these statutes, the president may seize property, organize and control the means of production, seize commodities, assign military forces abroad, institute martial law, seize and control all transportation and communication, regulate the operation of private enterprise, restrict travel, and in a plethora of particular ways control the lives of all American citizens.
Now, you said that whenever Congress does this, but in fact, it's the president who has been declaring the national emergency in every administration since 1933.
Yes, that's absolutely the case. If we go, you know, if we realize that what Congress told us there in 1973 was true, and that we had in fact lived all of our lives under emergency rule, with the Constitution under suspension, that then we can go to see where that authority and how that came into effect. And let's read the current law of today. Let's go to Title 12, USC, Section 95B, and let's see who and how it is that this government is really being operated. I'll read it. It's very short. It says, the actions, regulations, rules, license, orders, and proclamations heretofore or hereafter taken, promulgated, made, or issued by the President of the United States or the Secretary of the Treasury, since March the 4th of 1933, pursuant to the authority conferred by Subdivision B of Section 5 of the Act of October the 6th, 1917, as amended, are hereby approved and confirmed. That current law that's in the law books today, entitled 12 U.S.C., is cited at March the 9th of 1933, Chapter 1, Title 1, Section 1 of 48, Statute 1. Now, Bill, who does that say is ruling this country?
Well, it's obvious that there's a dictatorship run by the powers behind the president.
That's right, and that's called a dictatorship. In this fact, in this case, not a constitutional, but an unconstitutional dictatorship. And it says that every order that's been issued by the President of the United States or the Secretary of the Treasury since March the 4th of 1933 is automatically approved and confirmed. This is the power that goes to the executive branch of government to rule this country by order.
Now, you're not talking about something that happened a long time. You're talking about current law, and you just read it right out of the United States Code.
Yes, that's the current law of the day. And it says that every executive order that's been issued since March the 4th, 1933, or any executive order that's going to be issued in the future, is automatically approved and confirmed.
Now, how could they do that, Gene? And I'm asking questions in place of the radio audience asking them, because I have to ask the questions that they're obviously not able to ask.
Well, it says in the current law that it's being done under this authority that was conferred by subsection B of section 5 of this Act of October the 6th, 1917. Now, Bill, we have to realize that in 1917, this country entered World War I.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we went into the war. And on October the 6th of 1917, our government realized, remember, we went to war with Germany for the first time.
That's correct.
And they realized that there were enemies of the United States living within the continental shelves of the United States, primarily German citizens and citizens of the Allies who were allied to Germany at that time. So as a result, our government and our Congress passed an act. It was called an act to define, regulate, and punish trading with the enemy. okay?
Mm-hmm.
What this act fundamentally said was that everything that enemies do in this country, if they're within the jurisdiction of the United States, that the president will have total authoritarian power over enemies, that he has the power to issue any license, any order, any regulation to govern what enemies do, that he could control everything that they've done. At Section 5B of that act, under which the current law says the power is being derived, it says that the president may investigate, regulate, or prohibit, under such rules and regulations as he may prescribe by means of license or otherwise, any transaction in foreign exchange, the export or earmarking of gold or silver coin or bullion or currency, transfers of credit in any form. But then it says, other than credits relating solely to transactions to be executed wholly within the United States. So you see that the president, under this act, could control enemies.
Mm-hmm.
But under the definition of the word enemies, citizens of the United States were excluded from the provisions of this act. Realizing that the citizens of this country were not enemies of the United States, therefore, this government and this president did not have those kind of powers over we the people. And also at Section 5B, it specifically excluded the transactions that were to be executed wholly within the United States. Therefore, the citizens' transactions that were wholly domestic transactions were not involved in the power of this act. They only applied over enemies. Okay? That's a critical concept that we have to realize. But now we know that Senate Report 93-549, from which we just read, said that this country, since March the 9th of 1933, had been in a state of declared national emergency.
Mm-hmm.
If we go then to the Act of March the 9th, but before we go to that Act of March the 9th, let's read just a little bit from Roosevelt's inaugural address. Okay, Roosevelt, when he was inaugurated on March the 4th, and of course we know the current law says that all the proclamations since March the 4th of 33 are approved and confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
Roosevelt was inaugurated on March the 4th, and we know that in his inaugural address, we probably all remember from our history that he made this speech that says, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself."
Right. He also, didn't he ask for the powers to wage war against the emergency?
Let me read from his inaugural address. He says, "I am prepared under my constitutional duty to recommend the measures that a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world may require. These measures or such other measures as the Congress may build out of its experience and wisdom, I shall seek within my constitutional authority to bring to speedy adoption. But in the event that the Congress shall fail to take one of these two courses, and in the event that the national emergency is still critical, I shall not evade the clear course of duty that will then confront me. I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis, broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency, as great as the power that would be given to me if we were in fact invaded by a foreign foe." So you see that Roosevelt on March the 4th announces to the world that he is going to ask for this broad executive power to wage war, just as great as if we were, in fact, invaded by a foreign foe. Well, as it turns out, we were, in fact, invaded by a foreign foe. We were invaded by a foreign conquering power that came over us. That power was confirmed on March the 9th of 1933.
Mm-hmm.
This is critically important.
Now, who was the enemy?
Now, we know that under the Act of October the 6th, 1917, that we were not the enemy. We were specifically excluded. But Section 2 of this Act of March the 9th, 1933, which is now codified at 48 Statute 1, which is the current law of the day, says that Subdivision B of Section 5 of the Act of October the 6th, 1917, as amended, is hereby amended to read as follows. Now listen to the language as it's now permanently codified today. It says that during times of war or during any other period of national emergency declared by the President may, through any agency that he may designate or otherwise, investigate, regulate, or prohibit, under such rules and regulations as he may prescribe, by means of license or otherwise, any transactions in foreign exchange, transfers of credit between, or payments by banking institutions as defined by the President, and the export, hoarding, melting, or earmarking of gold or silver coin or bullion or currency, by any person within the United States or any place subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
So the enemy has now changed.
That's right. The definition of the word enemy has now changed.
And it
now applies to every person within the United States or any place subject to the jurisdiction thereof. The American people, under this amended act of March 9, 1933, have just been declared the same, given the same legal status as an enemy of the United States. We were in fact invaded by a foreign foe. This foreign foe that invaded us was our own Congress and our own president. When they changed the definition and made the people of the United States the enemy of the United States.
Now, they didn't just do this to play games, and they certainly didn't do it to make themselves rich, because none of them benefited all that much from what they did. So there must be a hidden agenda here.
Well, absolutely. That we did have a hidden agenda. And the thing, I think, to get to that hidden agenda, we have to go back and see who it was that wrote this act, who in reality had done the language. If we go back before March the 9th, we know that it says that all the regulations, rules, licenses, and orders that are issued since March the 4th. Well, on March the 5th, Roosevelt called for an extraordinary session of Congress to convene. He said, we have a national emergency. This Congress was to convene on March the 9th, 1933 at noon. This is the act they passed there on March the 9th. Well, on March the 6th, Roosevelt issued an executive order without Congress's approval, because Congress was not even in session. He done it as an absolute dictator, as an executive dictator.
That's
and
right.
He issued an order that said fundamentally that under the powers of October the 6th, 1917, that he had the power over all transactions and all banking institutions in this country. And under that executive order, 2039, he closed and seized the banks of this country and seized all the people's lawful gold and silver coin money. He done that as an executive dictator. But now if we go back and see who wrote that act, we can go back to March the 3rd of 1933, which was prior to Roosevelt being inaugurated. And we find in Hoover's papers that this same executive order was proposed to Hoover. It was proposed by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, who in fact had written the executive order word for word as Roosevelt introduced it as his executive order. Hoover declined to issue the executive order, saying that it was neither warranted or necessary. But Roosevelt, on March the 4th, in his inaugural address, announced to the world that he was going to use the war powers. That was the part we just read. He had already seen the executive order and, in fact, had worked with the Federal Reserve Board as early as February of 1933 to write that executive order. When he became president on March the 4th of 1933, he announced he would use this war power. On March the 6th, he instituted this executive order exactly as written by the Federal Reserve Board of New York. Now, why is it that the Federal Reserve Board would be issuing and writing this executive order for some president, whether it be Hoover or Roosevelt, to introduce? The reason was this, that the people had begun to line up at the banks, demanding their gold coin. Now, remember, in 1933, under the war powers, the Federal Reserve Act was first implemented, which allowed for the Federal Reserve banks to issue Federal Reserve notes upon the deposits of the assets of the people, which was the gold. But those Federal Reserve notes were redeemable in gold at face value. So consequently, prior to 1933, the people took their gold into the Federal Reserve banks and placed it on deposit. The Federal Reserve banks, in turn, gave them a note that said, anytime you want your gold, bring the note back to the bank, and we will return your gold to you. In March of 1933, the people were lined up at the banks with their notes demanding their gold. The Federal Reserve banks did not have the gold. They had already shipped most of the gold out of the country. So consequently, they were caught in their own acts.
And they had compounded this error by performing what we call fractional reserve lending anyway.
Yes, they had. They had issued literally hundreds of times more notes than they had gold in reserve to serve as the obligations upon them notes.
So even if they had not shipped a good portion of the gold out of the country, they still would have been in big trouble.
Deep, deep trouble. And they knew that. So consequently, they issued this executive order asking for military protection from the people themselves because they were caught in an act of theft.
So in fact, to the Federal Reserve, the people really were the enemy.
Yes, they were. Absolutely. To the Federal Reserve and to this foreign international power, because remember that the Federal Reserve banks had already entered into international agreements with the other foreign nations or with many of the foreign nations of the world to use the gold in the settlement of international transactions, that the gold was not here. They had already formed into international alliances with these other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So when the people came to the banks wanting their money, as was required under those notes, they didn't have it and they were caught.
Now, the real hidden agenda here, which is the reason for the international alliance and the real reason for the machinations that are aimed at the dissolution of the economy and the sovereignty of the United States, is something even deeper and more all-pervasive than that, that people are beginning to see in their daily life today, and that's world government.
Yes, it was, and it was beginning, and it began back under the League of Nations, back under Wilson, under World War One, at the same time these other acts came on board. So consequently, our country had entered into these alliances with the other countries under this League of Nations. And now the whole thing was brought to a head because the people were demanding the gold in this country. As a result, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York proposed this executive order. Hoover declined to issue it, but on March the 6th of 1933, Roosevelt issued this executive order exactly as written by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It was a banker's executive order. The president was acting as an agent for the international banks. It was a foreign power. It was, in fact, a foreign invasion. That foreign invasion won that war. The people were in desperate straits. There were desperate needs. I guess they would have followed anybody at that time. But as a result, we did not mount a substantive attack upon that foreign invasion, that we sat back and we allowed it to happen, probably mostly out of ignorance and out of desperation. But irregardless, we sat back and allowed that form of government to come over us. It was an international power under the law of nations. If we go to the memorandum of laws that attach to the Trading with the Enemy Act, we find that this is not the common law, that in fact it abolishes the common law of this country and it abolished our Constitution. And in fact, we went under the law of nations. It was part of the law of prize, the admiralty jurisdiction that came inland at that time, with that act.
And that has caused a plethora of snowball effects ever since.
Yes, it has.
It is, in fact, why some people can't understand. They call me and say, Bill, I was just in court. And I cited the Constitution, and I was told not to mention the Constitution in this court because it doesn't apply. And in fact, under this admiralty jurisdiction, it does not apply.
Yeah, that's right. It does not apply. That under the form of government we're under today, that the Constitution has been effectively set aside and the common law was effectively set aside with it. Let me read just a couple of these cases. Number one, the American cases that pertain to this Trading with the Enemy Act. And remember, once we were declared to be the enemy, this is the laws that now pertain.
Okay. Why don't you just hold those until after the break? We've got to take a little break here and tend to business, and we'll come right back to this specific spot. So don't go away, folks. We'll be right back with Dr. Gene Schroeder. And I know you're sitting on the edge of your chairs just enthralled by all of this. He is elaborating on what you've been hearing on the Hour of the Time for a long, long period of broadcast, and is certainly reasserting many of the things that I've told you and the warnings that I've given you. And, of course, you're hearing a few new things that he has dug up in his own research, and you're going to hear a lot more, so don't go away.
Everybody knows the dice is loaded. Everybody knows the family's club. Everybody Everybody knows that the war is over. Everybody knows that the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows the boat is sinking. Everybody knows that the truck is mad. Everybody's got his grip and steaming. Got their mama or the dog just died. Everybody's hands are in their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rule. Everybody knows.
Yes, folks, everybody knows. Everywhere I go across this country, everyone I meet without fail tells me when we enter into a conversation that something is terribly wrong. They can feel it in their gut. It's not something that's mysterious hanging off over the horizon that nobody knows about. Everybody in this country, and most people around the world, know that something is happening and something is terribly wrong, and they want to know what it is. And a lot of them spend a lot of time dodging any type of responsibility that comes with that knowledge. Now, I've been illuminating you, so to speak, for a long, long time, along with many others. Dr. Gene Schroeder is one who has devoted a good portion of his life to try to wake the American sheeple. Now, if you have listened to even a portion of the message that we have been attempting to deliver to you, then you know that in the resolution of this conflict, whether we win or they win, it doesn't really, at this point in time, matter to you. What matters to you right now is that you prepare for this conflict, because it's going to come to a head. And there will be a conflict, and it will be either resolved in the field of words, across a Congress, in a legislative battle, trying to bring about the will of the people to restore government, or it'll be brought about on the battlefield with bullets. But it will be resolved, and there will be a winner. And you don't want to be caught in the middle of this with your pants down, unprepared. One of the things that you're going to have is some kind of tradable commodity. Because when things begin to break down during this conflict, and they will, and even if it's resolved peaceably, there will be a period of time where the economy is being straightened out, where a devaluation of the dollar is inevitable. Nothing can stop it. It's going to happen. The only real money that's ever existed in the history of the world that has been acknowledged by all peoples in all countries at all times, during war, out of war, during total complete collapse, anarchy, or the height of flourishing civilizations, has been precious metals in their various forms, and specifically in the law of the United States and in the Constitution, that money is called gold and silver coin. Call our sponsors and do it now. You know we all tend to procrastinate. Talk to them about how you can acquire some real money that can get you through the hard times ahead. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Call now, folks. You'll be glad that you did. A great weight will be taken off your shoulders and you'll feel a lot better. Look around at your loved ones. If you can't look them in the eye and tell them that you've taken care of this specific problem, then you must make this call. If you don't want to deal with our sponsors, that's okay, but deal with someone. I care about you.
I don't want you to get hurt. So deal with someone. If you have derived real knowledge, real worth from listening to this broadcast, I hope that you will patronize those who have supported us, and that's Swiss America Trading. 1-800-289-2646. Do it now, folks. You'll be real, real happy that you did. You keep listening to the Hour of the Time, and you will find out what you're looking for. We'll give you all the answers, if not tonight, tomorrow night, or the next night. But cumulatively, this audience, the audience of the Hour of the Time, is the most well-educated body of people in the entire world. Welcome back, Dr. Schroeder.
Okay, Bill. Let's go to this memorandum of law that attaches with the Trading with the Enemy Act. And exactly what you were just saying on your commercial break was true. Let's read the first case. It's a wrap in 1814. Every species of intercourse with the enemy is illegal. And remember that we're now the enemy. This prohibition is not limited to mere commercial intercourse. If we go to the Trading with the Enemy Act in the body, it says, the trade or commerce regulated or prohibited is defined in subsections A, B, C, D, and E of this Act. This trade covers almost every imaginable transaction, and is forbidden and made unlawful except when allowed under the form of license issued by the Secretary of Commerce. This authorization of trading under license constitutes the principal modification of the rule of international law forbidding trade between the citizens of the belligerents. For the power to grant such license and therefore exemption from the operation of the law is given by the bill. So you see that what this is saying is that once we become the status or take on the status of an enemy, everything that we do is now illegal. The only way it can then be made legal is through some form of grant of permission from the government in the form of license, permits, or whatever.
And this is why all the things that never required licenses after 1933 had to be licensed, including marriage, including birth, everything.
Including driving, including anything that you want to do. That everything that the American people, who had originally derived their rights from God,
now
declared to be illegal.
The definition of an activity requiring license is something that is illegal under the law.
That's right. That's right. The only reason you have to have a license is because it is illegal. So you remember that the things that we could normally do as a right given, as an inherent right from God, were now declared to be illegal, and therefore we had to have a license from government in order to do it. It's amazing what happened. But as a result, because of those international agreements and because of this law of nations that now came over, and by the way, this is the law of nations, we can read this alley, by the general law of fries, property engaged in an illegal intercourse with the enemy is deemed enemy property. You see that this is the law of fries that now came over us, that no longer were we under the common law, no longer were we under our constitution, but now we were under this international law of nations, the law of fries, that we were subject as enemies to all of these international agreements. That basically the seven nations of the world, of the Western world, all declared emergency governments at the same time and declared the sovereign capacity of these nations. That they took all the rights of man and took them into the executive heads of these governments, declaring under this international agreement now that they were a one-world government. They made all the rules by international agreement, and we were then bound under the law of nations to these agreements.
Well, now that we know what's happened and how we got in the position that we're into, what do we do about it, Gene?
Let's talk, Bill, about the meeting that you participated in, myself, back in Kansas City just, 2 weeks ago?
A little more than that, but that's okay.
About 2 or 3 weeks ago, whenever that was, when the parties, the minor parties of the United States came together in that meeting. And out of that meeting, we reached an agreement that the parties would run one candidate for president, and that this president would have to agree that he was going to meet some of the criteria and do some of the things that the people or the parties that were present at that meeting agreed to do. One of the things that we talked about and we agreed that we would have to run a president who would agree to go back to Washington and issue the executive order to terminate this form of world government that's over us, this world power. And I think that's a critical step in the first, as a step in the right direction. Bill, why don't you go ahead and elaborate some of the things that the parties agreed to there?
Well, number one, of course, was the greatest accomplishment in my mind was getting all of these different disparate leaders of these disparate groups to agree on anything. And in the first meeting, which took place in early December, everyone agreed to what we call the Kansas City Resolution, which was to field one presidential and vice presidential candidate who would be committed to restoration of constitutional republican government and the dissolution of this world body and kick the United Nations completely off our soil and begin the process of restoration of the economy and the nation. And that, to me, was amazing.
Well, that was me also, that, it, you know, that the fact that we could bring people of such diverse interests into that meeting with you know, the parties and all their different beliefs to come together under that common agreement, that was also, to me, was simply amazing.
Another thing that I found surprising was that some of the people there did not have the depth of knowledge or the understanding that you and I and maybe some others had, and still understanding that something was wrong, were willing to listen and begin their process of education, which brought them up to speed, and I have to say, in a very short period of time. The second meeting, of course, was to find out, now, what are we going to do about this resolution? We've made the resolution. Now, how are we going to take action to make this come to pass? And we arrived at some conclusions there and put together some committees, and that really was not a fruitful meeting, other than we saw that it just wasn't a one-meeting thing, and we began to put together committees and people to bring up action plans to actually put this resolution into motion. And, of course, the third meeting was really two meetings, and I was not there for a good portion of the first meeting, so why don't you talk about that one?
Well, also, at that first meeting, I wasn't present for a good portion of that meeting also, Bill, so I couldn't specifically talk to that. But one of the things that I felt also was critically important was what you just mentioned, that even though a lot of the people that were there probably didn't have the levels of understanding that maybe you or I or some of the other people had going in, but it was obvious that once we could present the hard evidence to show what had happened, that then those people came up to speed very quickly, and they could see that there were very specific things that had to be done in order to begin to approach a resolution to this crisis that we're now in.
And one thing that everybody, and you know, there were some people there who are extremely intelligent and have been working all their life in the public sector and trying to make this a better country and a better world and a better city or whatever, wherever they came from. And one of the things that I found absolutely
enlightening and very promising, is that to a person, without exception, everyone realized that the answer does not lie in the established political process as it exists today.
I think that was obvious, that almost unanimously the people that were there agreed that the present process is dysfunctional, that it's not working and it's not going to work, that there have to be radical changes made.
And one of the things agreed to was that all of us are committed to making those changes, and that there's a, I believe that there's an awakening going across the country, not just amongst leaders, but amongst all of the people, that the Republican-Democratic Party are actually one party with two heads, all reaching for the same goal, and that is dissolution of the sovereignty of the United States of America, a complete elimination of probably the middle class, a redistribution of wealth in world government.
I think that's true. And now I think that became so obvious as we really began to look at some of the critical things that had happened, realizing that even though Roosevelt was a Democrat, that after Roosevelt, we've had, I think, 10 other administrations, both Republican and Democrat, and not one of those administrations has made any attempt to terminate this form of government that was imposed upon us by Roosevelt. That every one of those administrations, those presidents and those Congresses, had the opportunity to come forth with enough political courage to say, the crisis is over, the wars are over, and let's terminate this form of government and return back to our normal constitutional peacetime constitution. But not one of these administrations have done it, whether Republican or Democrat.
Not only that, but none of them have ever made any effort to turn away from the path that the previous administrations have set us on.
That's right. It seems as though it's almost the inherent nature of governments. And I guess history should teach us something, that once a government gains power, it's very reluctant to give that power back up to the people. And so I guess in that respect, that's what's happened in this country is no different than probably what we would expect of any other government on the face of this earth.
Well, you know the old, well, I don't know if you know or not, but there's an old saying about children. You know, you'd be very careful what you give children, because you can give it to them, but it's very difficult to take it away. And by golly, that applies a thousand times over for power and wealth. When you give someone power, they're likely to fight you to the death before they give up an inch of it.
Yes, they are, and especially when you talk about power on the scale that's been developed worldwide now under this form of government for the last 61 years. Remember, you know, that this entire Industrial Revolution began to take place during this same period of time we're talking about. And think of the enormous power, wealth, that's been accumulated now in the hands of this international government that was formed back then. Obviously, they're going to be very reluctant to give it up.
That's why I find it very difficult to talk to some people who really believe that there's going to be some kind of a peaceful political resolution to this along traditional lines. There may be a peaceful resolution, but it's certainly not going to be along traditional lines. And it's difficult when you're talking to someone who believes that to really, even when they understand, it's hard to get them to look at reality. Now, in that first meeting of the last attendance that we had there in Kansas City, which was in early February, the first meeting was actually to discuss how our team, so to speak, once we win the election, I believe that we can do that, once they establish their administration in Washington, how they're going to return the economy to constitutional money and an economy that works not on a debt-based system, but on a real people-created wealth-type system. And I got to tell you, you know, I was not at a good portion of that meeting. I came in late, but I did participate for the portion that I was there and quite vociferously, because I saw that there was a faction there that did not understand really what constitutional money was and had all kinds of outlandish plans, although they may have been well-intended and they may have been good plans if that kind of a thing was what was desirable.
it was a battle to get that on track to where constitutional money was what we were really talking about.
Yes, it was. And of course, there at Article 1, Section 10, I mean, it's very explicit, where it says that no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin in tender and payment of debt.
I think the big thing that mattered so much to most people was the admonition that if we really believe in what we say we believe in, if we're really who we say we are, then before we monkey with anything, we must return to a Republican constitutional form of government, which means constitutional money, and then deal with whatever changes need to be made legitimately and not through fraud or deceit or
crisis or whatever.
Right.
And I agree so much with what you had said at that meeting that whatever our opinions are really are of no significance, are they?
That's
correct. That we have a law, a supreme law of the land. And if we're going to return to it, then we must return to it, irregardless of what our opinions are. Then if we have opinions that differ from that supreme law of the land, there are legitimate ways under that Constitution that we can amend it, but only once we get it back into its normal peacetime mode.
That's correct.
And I think one of the things that, I think this is why education is so important, Bill, and I think probably we could see it at that meeting, that once the people begin to come up to speed with some of the specifics of what we were talking about, then we began to get agreement, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Only once they began to understand more specifically what we were dealing with before they come around and said, well fundamentally, you're right,
mm-hmm.
that these are the things we have to do. And I think going into that meeting that many of us realized that we, let's go back to what Roosevelt said there on his documents when he issued that Proclamation 2039 and seized the money of the people. Now, he says, after he issued that proclamation, this is Roosevelt speaking in his own notes. He says, we knew that it would be essential when the banks reopened to have an adequate supply of currency to meet all possible demands of the Fosters. You see that really we're not in any different position what Roosevelt was, are we?
No, not at all.
We terminate this form of government that's existed over us all these years. Then when we terminate, there's no money, is there?
No, not at all.
I mean, there is absolutely no money. The banks are all closed again.
In fact, if we wanted to be absolutely honest in the concept of the definition of real money, there's no real money today.
That's right, and there is none today. So realizing that we fundamentally said the same thing when we went into that meeting, that we knew that if we terminate this form of government, when the banks reopen Monday morning, there has to be an adequate supply of money to meet all the demands of the depositors, don't there?
Right.
Because if there's not, then we've got automatic chaos. We've got immediate crisis in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And we were hoping to come up with some form of an agreement that would be constitutional, that at least we could come into a soft landing. That we don't want this thing to crash if we can prevent it, do we?
That's correct.
So that was the dilemma that we had to work through in that meeting. And I think it was from the understandings of specifically what it went wrong, and specifically of the understandings of what our Constitution requires, that we were able to come to at least to those fundamental agreements. That there would have to be, certainly, a new currency issued. Or we didn't even call it currency, we called it the money, didn't we?
That's right.
And that money had to be backed by gold and silver coin.
That's correct.
So we made that agreement that we don't know how much gold there is, we don't know how much silver there is. We haven't had an audit of that thing in 61 years. But there's some there, surely. And whatever amount is there is going to have to back the new money that's issued. And the new money that will be issued will have to be issued as a debt-free, interest-free money that will not represent an obligation or a debt upon anyone. And that's a fundamental characteristic of the money that's going to have to be issued when we terminate this form of government. I think we all realize that if we are effective and we do elect a president that will go back and do the things that have to be done, that was one of the first agreements we had to get to, in order to prevent chaos from reigning in this country when we do it.
That's correct.
And needless to say, Bill, and with the help of everyone, with a lot of hard work and perseverance, we were able to come up with those fundamental agreements. That was a critical, critical first step.
And even some tears.
Yes, there were. And with a lot of praying, wasn't there?
Yes, absolutely. the amount of true dedication and real feeling and I don't believe that anyone there would have hesitated for one instant to give their life for this country if they were called upon to do it without hesitation at any given moment. And that's the kind of people that we were dealing with. That set the stage for the next meeting that resulted in the organization known as CURE, which I've already told you all about, and urged you to begin to form your tab teams and get involved. And we're just out of time, so I don't want to get into that tonight. And we're going to talk more about that on some of that. Do you have enough material that you'd like to come back tomorrow night, Gene?
Certainly, I'd be glad to do that, and maybe we can come back, and another thing I'd like to talk about maybe a little bit tomorrow night briefly is this common law grand jury that's been called, this national grand jury that's set in Wichita, Kansas for June the 3rd and the 4th.
I was hoping that you'd want to talk about that, but I didn't want to twist your arm.
Let's talk about that tomorrow.
Okay, good. Do you have an address or a phone number where people can reach you if they wish, and do you have any materials that they can obtain from you, Gene? We didn't even talk about that before the broadcast.
We just issued that book, Constitution Fact or Fiction.
Okay.
It fundamentally deals with some of these problems. If anyone would like to have information on that book, they could call an 800 number. That number is 1-800-610-4908.
Okay, folks, you heard him. 1-800-610-4908. And I've got to tell you something. I've known Dr. Gene Schroeder for some time now, and I've known about him and read a lot of the things that he's done and listened to him for a long time before I ever met him. So I can tell you without even seeing his book that it's worth acquiring, and his depth of knowledge and the amount of research and study that he's done on the problems that exist in America today are right up there on top with the very best that you can find. So call 1-800-610-4908. That's 1-800-610-4908, and ask about how you can get his book. Gene, thank you. We'll see you again tomorrow night.
Very good, Bill. Same time.
Same time, same station. Good night, my friend. And good night, ladies and gentlemen, and God bless each and every single one of you.
All of a sudden, in the middle of the night, there's a loud knock on your door. Hey, honey. Something's not right.
Pull out your arms. It's the Temple of Massacre. We're here for the government. We're here to help you.
And I'm from the IRS with a foreign attack. Did you got a complaint? Think of the fact.
Get out of this house. Surrender your guns. Give me your gold. You may obey if you want to go home. That's the good stuff and do what you're told.
Hillary Salala, Reno Janet Dyke, reading the words of General Albert Pike, demonic founder of the Ku Klux Klan, engineer of the Masonic Master Plan. Pike said Lucifer is God across this land, and Clinton saying take the mark in your right hand. While we're all dancing to the drums of Buffalo's right, Clinton's preparing it for another huge tax hike. Order out of chaos, depression, inflation, create the panic and rape the nation. Order out crisis creation. Incite black and white programs and education. While we're all dancing to the drums of Buffalo's right, Clinton's preparing it for another huge tax hike. Order out of chaos, depression, inflation, create the panic and rape the nation. Order crisis creation. Incite black and white programs and education. Hit the mark in
raise your right hand. We're all dancing to the drums of uproar, right? Clinton's preparing it for another huge tax hike.